Fletcher Henderson and his orchestra opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a 1931 recording of the House of David Blues. Every Monday on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we feature Marion McPartland's piano jazz. Today she's joined by Oscar Peterson for some duets and conversation. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be here at her regular Monday time, 3:30, to review new museum and gallery shows around town. Ted Solotaroff is a literary editor who has worked with writers like Tom Robbins and Norman Mailer. His essays on literature used to appear regularly in commentary. He was also the editor of the New American Review, a paperback series of short stories and essays. Solotaroff will discuss literary editing and his observations on literature today when he joins us at about 2:45. With me now is the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Sunday book page, Rebecca Sinclair. Yesterday in the Inquirer, she featured a list of the best books of 1980, and in her column wrote about the trends of the past year. She's been the book editor for the Inquirer for a little over a year now. She previously worked as an editor of Today magazine. She freelanced and she wrote for the short-lived publication The New Paper. She's also written an unpublished novel, which she says is a spoof about a whacked-out family who live in a Chestnut Hill mansion. We'll be talking about recent book trends and about how she puts the book page together. Welcome to Fresh Air, Rebecca Sinclair.
Thank you, Sherry. Nice to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the trends you've identified in the past year. And I wanted to say that I certainly knew what you mean about how it was a relief to do this after last year, at the end of the year. There was a whole decade to plow through.
Indeed.
Everybody did their best of the decades. So what were some of the trends you saw during this past year?
Well, first of all, I should make it very clear that I've only been a book editor for 1 year. So for me to really give a long-range commentary on trends would be out of place, I think. What I noticed, just bringing my own fresh eye to the material that came in last year, were some startling things. I hadn't realized, for instance, the degree to which fact and fiction had begun to meld and blur in American literature. I think that there's really Norman Mailer doing this all the time. It started probably back with Truman Capote in the 50s, but Mailer has taken it a long way, and Arianna Fallaci, who's just written a wonderful book, really, called A Man, which is, as far as I could see, very much a factual story, has chosen to call that a novel. Mailer is again back with Marilyn Monroe, and in this case he is stepping into her head and actually speaking for her. And there are others, I can't think of any right now, but that's one of the trends I've noticed. The other trend I've noticed is just an enormous amount of biography. To the extent that it really overpowers the works of straight history or sociology. We seem to want to take our facts mixed in with a good dose of personality. There's also a trend, I think, about particularly noticeable this year, to go back to a simpler time. And just as the people who voted for Ronald Reagan, I think a certain conservatism has shown up in the book world, where people who, like Erica Jong, who, what can you write after you've written Fear of Flying about women's liberation? So Erica Jong then goes back to the 18th century, and where, what can you say about the urban situation after you've written Looking for Mr. Goodbar? So Judith Rosner goes back to the 19th century. E.L. Doctorow has gone back to the, well, he did that before in his earlier books, but in Loon Lake. I just see more preoccupation with other eras, and I think this is partly a search for simpler solutions and maybe just nostalgia. Even our most modern writer, like Tom Robbins, he's very contemporary, but he's going back to the camel's pack that was designed in 1920 or something. I can't actually remember that date, but a lot of nostalgia, a lot of backward looking.
Oh, this probably isn't a valid comparison at all, but someone like James Michener has been writing historical novels that are steeped in the long-term history of a nation for years, and I think his new one is at the top of the bestseller list.
Right, The Covenant. It really goes back to the Stone Age, and I might add, too, novels all along the spectrum, from the most literary to the most pop novels, are going all the way back to the Stone Age, which really I do think is new. I think William Golding did that once in the 50s, but it was kind of a fluke. Now we have 5, 6, 7 books with that theme.
Last year at about this time, one of the overwhelming trends in books was self-help books. There seemed to be an enormous number of them. Has that died down?
Never.
Do you think,
no,
this year?
It hasn't died down. I think that's very prevalent. Always will be.
What are some of the books you've enjoyed reading most over the past year?
Over the past year, I've really read mostly fiction. I shouldn't say that. I've read a lot of different books, but the ones I've enjoyed most and found most interesting and original have been fiction. Man in the Holocene is a very small book by a Swiss playwright, not very well known in America, and it was one of those books which, like very many of our best books, come right straight out of New Yorker series, those great big 3-issue series. This book came out in the New Yorker. I read part of it there, was intrigued, decided to pick up the book and review it myself, and I was just fascinated. Again, that's one of the books that goes back, or it doesn't take place in the Ice Age or anything, but it does relate to that. There's a great deal of sort of paleontology and history of man from the very beginnings in that book, and I think handled beautifully.
Let's talk a little bit about the philosophy of the book page. You have a double page every Sunday, and sometimes that goes over to the page behind it. What would you say is your goals or philosophy of putting together the page?
Well, I get to review or assign for review, other people review them, about 11 books a week. And when you figure that into my office come about 400 books a week, enormous mailbags full are heaped up on my door every morning, and we open them, and I, so obviously most books don't get reviewed. I want to reach, let's say the whole book, the publishing industry is a huge panorama. I want to focus my camera on a section of that panorama that is fairly mainstream, and yet I want to be able to go to either end of very, very trashy pop fiction to very literary and esoteric stuff of real interest. And I really tend towards idiosyncrasy. What's helped me to do that was a feature that I introduced into the book pages, which is the capsule reviews. Rather than giving an enormous major review to every book and having to whittle down the page to about 6 books, I like to spread this. I just feel that this is my mad money. I can have all kinds of silly things, or if a book is really hitting the bestsellers that I had ignored, I will assign it quick and say, quick, do something on this for me. It really looks like people are reading it. Let's say something about it. So I try to hit as many interest groups as I can imagine and fulfill my own curiosity as well.
If you have 400 books coming to your door every week, how do you sort them out and try to figure out what you're going to review and what you're going to put aside?
Well, there are several ways. First of all, there are those books which you know automatically you're going to review. You know, the next Philip Roth novel or the next Gay Talese sexual discussion or the big blockbuster on Walter Lippmann or something is necessarily going to be reviewed. You don't have to think about that. Then I have 2 publications that I read, and all book reviewers subscribe to this. I think I can safely say that. Publishers Weekly comes once a week. There's another little crib sheet called Kirkus Reviews. I think all libraries get those, and I get them. And they give you capsule reviews of books maybe 3 months in advance. And with that, you take that home and you think what among those books of very high merit. There's always more than you can fit on the page. They're always, this is the most wonderful book ever on this subject. So you just have to sort of wing it. And those are a help. Also, I get a lot of help from my reviewers, who are a very well-informed, well-read bunch of people, and they cover various fields, like Arthur Sabatini, who's a regular reviewer, really tracks foreign literature very carefully. Other people, Rich Nichols, tracks American lit as I try to myself, other people are into something, and they'll always flag me if something very exciting is coming up.
For the books that you're making a decision about, you pick up the book. You can't read every book to see if it's worth reviewing. You're only going to read it if you decide to review it. Mm-hmm. So where are the key places you're going to look in a book to try to evaluate it?
Well, it's different for different kinds of books. This may sound funny, but after a while of looking at maybe 30, 40 books a day, you pick up a kind of instinct in the language. If you pick up a book and turn to page 32 and you don't know what it's talking about and jump into a paragraph, you can find a paragraph that is so deadly, you won't put the book down after that one paragraph. You maybe go to the sixth. There's a certain quality of aliveness that jumps off a page at you. And I guess my experience as an editor, also a magazine editor, gave me an eye for the kind of prose that just seems to take you to the next sentence. In books like biographies and histories, you look at the other things like the index and the bibliography to see if you think that the man has or woman has touched bases on the other work that's been done in the field, or if this is just something they've woven straight out of their heads. I guess it's an instinct you develop, and you know you miss a lot, you know, you make a lot of mistakes, but you just got to trust that instinct.
Now, I don't have to remind you of the cliche that you can't tell a book by its cover. On the other hand, the book cover has information in it. How do you use the information in a book cover?
I'll tell you one very funny story. I picked up a new novel I'll have to make this all nameless because it would be most embarrassing to some people, but I picked up a book, a third in a trilogy of a famous writer, and turned it over, looked at the blurbs on the back, which is one of the things that I do. If the blurbs are by people who I know and they seem to say intelligent, interesting, provocative things, I look twice at the book. So I looked twice at this book, and there was this blurb saying, this man is one of our finest writers, blah, blah, blah. And it was signed by another of our finest writers, who I truly believe is a very good writer, and he's also done some book reviews for me. So I immediately called his house, and he wasn't home. I called, got his wife, and I said, would you mind passing on the message to X that I'd like him to review X's book? And the wife just roared with laughter and said, oh, he would never, he can't stand that guy. And I said, what do you mean? The blurb's on the back. He said, well, he was a friend, and he did a nice book review for my husband once, but he said he couldn't possibly get through one of those books. They're terrible. That was an eye-opener.
Well, I think we all read the blurbs on the back of books, and of course they're always really glowing and positive, and they try to find the names of authors who would be of interest to a potential reader of that book. So if it's if it's a book about feminism, the leading feminist will be quoted in the back there. If it's a modern novel, modern novelist will be quoted. Yeah. But how do they get those quotes? Do you know that?
Yeah, I think editors and publicists from the publishing houses send galleys out and beg for blurbs. It's a little mini industry of its own, and I trust it less and less as I go along. I can't believe some of the blurbs from reputable people, so I don't believe them too much anymore after my long years' experience. I take that with a jaundiced eye. Of course, you have to take the flyleaf with a jaundiced eye because that's publicity, largely what the little description of the writer, which tells what he's written before and what qualifies him to write if it's nonfiction about the subject.
You know what I always find to be very telling in a book of nonfiction is the preface, if it's, or the introduction, if the author of the book has written it, because somehow they take off their cloak of expertise and become a person talking to you very directly about what it was like to write this book and why they did it, and it's sometimes very, very revealing.
Yeah, I will look at prefaces.
How do you decide who's going to be reviewing a certain book?
Okay, I try to use my imagination and get somebody who, well, first of all, is qualified, who knows something about the field, and But secondly, I'd sometimes like to get somebody who has such a strong axe to grind that it's quite obvious. I remember a book on, I think it was called The Tranquilizing of America, which was a diatribe against the use of tranquilizers, and I sent it to Timothy Leary thinking he might have some position to take on it. And actually, he was as against tranquilizers as the next person. I guess I was surprised at that. I thought he would really say this is all pious hogwash, but he was outraged at the use of Valium when you think he's spent a lot of his life on LSD. It's so funny.
He reviewed another book for you, and I can't remember which
one
it
was. Yeah, it was one of those, the Woodstock Generation book.
Right.
And it was wonderful. I thought it was a very good review and knowledgeable. And
did you know him already, or can you just take the liberty of sending
books to people?
You can call up.
Almost anybody. Well, not almost anybody. There are exceptions, like my friend Philip Ruff, who was actually my teacher. He taught me a course at Penn on book reviewing. It was a wonderful course. I learned a lot from it. So, of course, the day that I got this job, I called up Philip and said, "Oh, Philip, great, you're going to review him for me." And I had a book I wanted him to do, and I said, "Will you do it?" And he said, "Of course not." He said, "I don't know how to review books." And you'll notice that he does not do reviews. He does interviews, but he does not do book reviews.
Nevertheless, is there information that he passed on in the course that you find yourself drawing on?
Sure, including some stuff from your next visitors, Ted Solotaroff, some wonderful things that he wrote about book reviewing.
Has it ever happened to you that you've assigned a book to someone, and in the interim between the time it was assigned and the time you got the review back, you read the book yourself?
Yes.
And found that your opinion of the book differed radically from the reviewer's opinion of the book. What are you going to do in a situation like that?
Well, there's really very little I can do. I'd like to sort of go nameless with this because I don't want to take on one of my reviewers on this program, but a very good novel came out about this August, and I assigned it to a person who I thought would be good, and his feeling was, "Oh, yes, I'd like to do a book by that author. I've read everything that he or she has written, and I can't stand it." And I thought, well, that's all right. This is a very established writer and one of the sacred cows, and let's take it on. Well, he did take it on and savaged the book, and I read it, and not only that, but I met the author and became friends with it. To make this very anonymous, and was sort of devastated by this review. I did, to be honest, I did what I would do with any review. I tried to cut down on the sarcasm in the reviewer's review because I don't like sarcastic reviews unless in some very, very needy, when the book really cries out for it, all right, But I just don't like to read sarcastic put downs of books. I don't think they're helpful. So I took out some of the most sarcastic edge of this thing, but I have to let it fly. I can't impose my own tastes on a reviewer.
I guess it must be hard for you sometimes, though.
Yeah, it is.
Some authors just crank out books all the time, and it's in a way no big deal for them. But other people will spend 3 or 4 years of their life writing a book. So what feeling of responsibility does that leave you with when you're reviewing just years and years of someone's work?
Well, it depends on the book. Again, if you take something like Gay Talese's book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, he worked on it for 9 years, and I think there wasn't a national magazine that didn't cover some part of the story of what he was doing, and it was so super hyped by the time it came out, and was a book of questionable value. It got a lot of attention, and I had no compunction at all about running a review that was said exactly what the reviewer thought about it. On the other hand, if it's somebody who's, I just can't think of an example right now, somebody of who has written a very serious, maybe the Justin Kaplan biography of Walt Whitman that came out has taken him years, but frankly, it shows it. It's a wonderful book. I think that maybe you're thinking of a particular book that you have in mind.
No, I'm not really. Yeah. But I was just thinking about how hard it would probably be to say negative things about someone who you knew had spent years writing something. But then I think again of a friend of mine who used to review theater, and once he reviewed a production, and the cast had obviously just really worked so hard, but it was terrible.
Yes, you have to.
Yeah, and they said, well, we worked so hard on this, how can you give it a bad review? Yeah. And, and so he had to say, well, hard work doesn't necessarily make for good art.
You owe your readers. You owe the writer fairness and an open mind, although, yeah, an open mind, really. And you owe them a fair description of the book, but I don't think you owe them anything in the judgment of its quality. You owe your readers everything in that case.
When you're reading a book that you're going to review, do you read it straight through? Do you ever skim it?
No. When I'm doing a book for an interview, I often skim it, and you just have to do that. But a book I review, I read usually twice, if not three times.
Mm-hmm.
And go back, and I make notes in the margins and all over the place.
My guest is Rebecca Sinclair, if you're just joining us, and she's the book editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And yesterday in the Sunday Inquirer, she featured a list of the best books of 1980. And then in her column, she wrote about trends of 1980. There's a lot of, not a lot, but there's local authors, some of whom you review, some I imagine who you don't review. I'm sure people call you all the time and say, how about reviewing my book? Is it hard to say no to someone, particularly if they're an area author?
It is hard to say no to them, and quite often I'll get around that by agreeing to do an interview with them for my column or something like that. Of course, local authors run the gamut. James Michener is a local author, and Arthur Sampson's a local author. There are authors who have established track records, and I would never ask a reviewer to be gentle or to give special treatment to a local author. I might and do assign books on the basis that their subject is particularly interesting locally. There are books that, for instance, that are put up, Temple University Press or University of Pennsylvania, who do stories about what the working class family was like in the first half of the century, or a black slave who had come and lived in Philadelphia and his experiences, in the 1880s. This would not likely get a national review, and I do think that there are some books that would never see the light of review, so I try, but again, you always come back to the 160 inches of type that you can play with every week, and you cannot be too kind just on the basis of local interest.
You might get a lot of negative feedback if you run a negative review on a local author. I know a lot of people feel that it's the almost responsibility of people in editorial positions to support the products and productions of area artists and writers.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I don't feel that way. Again, my duty is to the reader. I feel that the element of support is important, and I think I fulfill that by assigning the book in the first place. After that, the book is on its own. A book has a life of its own. You cannot shelter it any more than you can shelter a child. It is out there, and the world will judge it. And if you try to crib for it or lie for it, it's like doing your child's homework. It's just not going to help anyone.
That's an interesting way of describing it. Now, there's also a lot of people who write for vanity presses, which is when you have written a manuscript and you pay for the publication of it. Do you ever review things on vanity presses?
No, my general inclination is to never do that. I will look at them, particularly if it's a local author. I look at it and give it a quick once over. But usually, you find the vanity presses publish books which for one reason or another have not been able to find a publisher for good reason. They're not as good as other books. There are exceptions, of course. There's the big national bestseller now, the On a Clear Day You Can See General Motors, which was a book that nobody would publish because it was just too hot, and I was afraid that the Teamsters might burn down their building or something like that. And so DeLorean went and arranged for this to be published. But that's quite different than something by a national vanity press like Vantage.
Mm-hmm. Do you have time to read for pleasure?
funny way of putting it, the way reading is a pleasure to me. So no matter what I read, it is my pleasure. And it is almost my only hobby and recreation. I love it. It's a really wonderful thing that I have a job in which I can do just exactly what I want to do.
What if you get the urge to read a 19th century author? They obviously don't have any new books out. Do you have the time to...
No, that's the thing I miss most probably, is going back and picking up the Faulkner that I haven't read, or the George Eliot that I haven't read, or poetry, which I really like and I don't get a chance to read. And yeah, I always read for pleasure, but I will never be able to read as much as I please.
What are some of the books you really loved reading when you were young?
Okay, I was a sort of a frightful little prig. I stopped reading children's books when I was about 9 or 10, and up until then, I think I just read everything that was put in front of me and sort of memorized a few of them. I remember Ludwig Bemelmann's Madeline, reading it over and over until I probably could recite it right now. But I must have been pretty little then. And I read just about anything, and up until when I was about 10 or 11, I started reading things like Jane Eyre and Rebecca. Lorna Doone, I remember loving, and Trilby, all sort of ladies' novels of the late 19th century, not very good. Well, Jane Eyre was probably, but some of the other trash, I guess gothics and all that, I hit very early. And I read, I sort of read broadly. I really did read anything. I would go to the library and just pick out some book by somebody I had never read and read it, bring it home and read it. I read everything in my parents' bookshelves, and I read Mickey Spillane and Agatha Christie, and I got almost thrown out of boarding school for importing a book to the class's delight called Over 16, which was a book of dirty jokes.
Yeah, I remember, that. I had a copy in my house. I used to read it.
Well, I was almost sent packing on that one. And this also sounds like a frightful little prig, but my mother and I used to sit around after supper and read Shakespeare together. I remember reading Macbeth and The Taming of the Shrew. The only problem is she took all the good parts. And she, you know, she was Lady Macbeth, and I was... the guard, and she was Catherine, and I was, you know, the lady in waiting. But anyway, we did that. That was a lot of fun, and along with Mickey Spillane, it was sort of a rich diet of almost anything.
Can you remember what was required reading in high school?
I really had a very happy and good high school education. I had one teacher who had for 3 years. It was a funny. I went to a funny school, and he just happened to be a very, very good teacher. And again, it was a lot of Shakespeare, it was like a lot of Conrad, a lot of Faulkner. And it was a boarding school that I went to, and we had almost no social life or pleasure at all, except for that this teacher used to have an open house on every night after dinner from about 8 o'clock till 9:30 or something. We would go down there, and you actually got food, which was always an advantage. Mm-hmm. And he would read us mainly funny stuff. He would read us Thurber and George Ade and Mark Twain and stuff that was never on our required reading list, but was just so painless. He was a very good reader and funny. It was better than television or anything. He would just keep us all entertained. And I never found, Ethan Frome I couldn't get through, but... Who can?
That was required reading when I was in school.
Yeah,
That's nice experiences. I'm sure a lot of people would have less happy literary experiences from high school to share.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the column that you do, which is also featured every Sunday on the book page. What are some of the things you try to do with your column?
Okay, I sort of split on the column between two things. I like to interview authors, although... you don't get an awful lot to say in about 6 or 8 inches with an author, but I like to meet them and talk to them and find out what they're doing. And then I think people like to read about personalities. As we all know, it's kind of where everything is at these days. Then the other thing I like to do is keep up with publishing news, with trends, with cover the major stories in the publishing world. It's hard to do, again, in a short column. And I also like to, every once in a while, just plug a little book that I know I won't have time to review or space to review. Or the other thing is I very, very rarely review or assign for review self-help books, and I think they are just enormously popular and sometimes enormously helpful. So I reserve my column to talk about certain interesting and good self-help. Or
why won't you review them?
Well, because frankly, I think there's so much out there of serious fiction and nonfiction and fantasy and science fiction and other things that I think the good self-help books manage to, again, have a life of their own, to get around the talk shows do them to death. They get their fair share of print and in the people pages, for instance, of the newspaper, The Inquirer. That's pretty well covered. So again, it is just a question of those 400 books and which 11 you're going to do. You have to make some. You just have to draw the line somewhere.
Mm-hmm. When you interview someone whose book you've read or are about to read, do you think that the impression they make on you as a person affects what you think of them as a writer?
Yeah, it definitely does. That's why I don't like two things. I don't like to do a column on a person whose book I will be reviewing unless it's after the review is in. And because I do, I'm very sensitive to what they may feel about the review, and I just try to keep that separate.
Do you ever find that some people talk a good line, but their writing isn't as good?
Oh, very definitely. They can make a book sound absolutely fascinating over a lunch table that you pick up and is just deadly.
There's a new feature that you've added recently to the book page, and that's the local bestseller list. And it's interesting to compare that sometimes with the national bestseller list. What are some of the comparisons that you've made, some of the interesting differences and similarities?
Well, first of all, our bestseller list predicts. I have often, you know, called a publisher and say, hey, I hope you realize that your ex-author is about to jump onto the national list because it's been appearing on our list for 2 or 3 weeks. The reason is not that Philadelphia is so terribly avant-garde or with it, although I'm sure we are, but the real reason is the books are the last few passengers in the United States to travel by train. And for the time it takes a book to get out to California into the bookstores and therefore start appearing on Publishers Weekly list or the New York Times list, it takes a good 3 to 4 weeks longer than ours. It gets to Philadelphia immediately, almost as fast as New York, and it's in the window of Dalton's or Sessler's, and people are grabbing it up. Now, secondly, we do have a great, you know, support the home team spirit in this city, it seems. People like you, maybe, are helping that along, interviewing local authors and doing things like that. There have been books that will probably never make national bestseller lists that appear on our bestseller list. There's a doctor at Penn right now, Dr. David Burns, who has a book called Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, which has consistently been on our list, which has made Dr. Burns feel very good. And he, so far, it has not hit national lists. It may, because it's going to be done by, picked up by Reader's Digest, and I assume that will probably put it up there. But this city has been behind that book for 6-8 weeks.
Do you find any correlation between what's been given a good review in the Inquirer and what makes it to the bestseller list?
Gee, I'd like to say that I do, but it's too erratic for me to be able to say that. As a matter of fact, I have my doubts about what good reviews do to the life of any book. Again, I really feel a book has a life of its own. Aside from the fact that probably more books are sold by talk shows, by Dick Cavett or Phil Donahue, than by the pages of newspaper book reviews. I really have no statistics, and I don't think anybody has statistics on this. All I can tell you is some of the books that get really the worst reviews, like the Gay Talese book, and I don't think there was a single positive review on that book. Of course, it was on the bestseller list for months, and other books that never get reviewed at all managed to get up there by word of mouth, by by fans who are looking for X latest book. They know to look for it. When they see it, they buy it.
Do you watch Donahue or Cavett to see who's on and how they present themselves?
Donahue's at a time of day that I can't watch. And Cavett, I don't see them all. I often do. Yeah.
Do you get much feedback from readers about books and book reviews?
Yeah, I do. I got, for instance, this morning I must have gotten 8 or 10 calls. People arguing vehemently about the books that were on the list and the books that were omitted. And people have very high, very strong feelings about books, and they do call up and get angry, including the authors, who from time to time write, particularly an inexperienced author will write and almost want to sue you for a bad review. But
why do you think it's the inexperienced authors who do that?
Because experienced writers have learned either to ignore reviews, protect themselves from them by not reading them, or they've gotten tough enough, although I think most writers will always be sensitive. Or lastly, I think that the real thing experience tells us that to get your book reviewed at all is going to get it read, and that frankly, that's what an experienced author wants, is reviews, be they good or bad.
Are there any books or reviews that have given you the most feedback from your readers?
Reviews?
Yeah.
I can't think of one right now. Maybe you come back to that. One might come to mind.
Do publishers ever send you angry letters saying, "Hey, this is a great book, and why'd you give it such a bad review?"
No, more in the form of angry phone calls. But publishers, publicists, it is in the interest of the publicist to be your best friend, and they're really. They're not going to burn any bridges by insulting you. I'm sure they want to. I'm sure they get infuriated.
There's an enormous amount of publicity that the publishers send out. What's some of the most outlandish publicity you've seen?
Well, I've gotten everything from silk garters to bottles of whiskey to one publisher really just streamlined the whole thing by sending me a dollar bill. In the book, which it was a book about how to make your money grow or something like that, but I just still thought it was kind of outrageous to be sending money. And I remember one time a publicist called me up and said, "We've got this great book about a guy who is the second coming of Christ, and can you think of a building in Philadelphia that he could crucify himself on a on a steel girder?" And I said, "Well, offhand, I really don't think I can help you with that." But there have been. I mean, shortly after I took over this job, there was that guy, the crazy guy that rented a helicopter or a light plane, a little private plane, and buzzed the United Nations. Do you remember that? And yeah, people will do almost anything. Oh, including our own local author, Myra Chanin, who has sent cheesecakes to probably 500 bookstores in the United States, including a photograph of herself with nothing on.
Okay. You've been to a book convention recently, too. What goes on there to attract the attention of reviewers and bookstore owners to certain books?
Well, it is a real carnival. Again, they're giving away almost just an enormous amount of bribery in the form of small gifts, well, free books for one thing, and all kinds of bags and paraphernalia and stuff, which I hasten to say that I don't accept. Also, enormously fancy parties. And my mistake, really, in going to the first book convention was to sort of mistake the biggest party for the best book that would be published that year, and that just simply... I think you have to be wary about the claims. They have a little sort of an amphitheater about the size of the room that we're sitting in right now, which is like a bedroom size, and this is a little place where they trot the authors in one after another with outlandish, really actually animal acts. One of the people came with a cockatoo sitting on her head, and another, you know, they put on their little dog and pony routines for 10 minutes, and everybody from Jerry Ford to the cockatoo lady give you this little act. And it's a very much a circus and a crazy sort of a world. It's fun, but you have to be very wary. One of the books that was being really touted out there was something called The Clan of the Cave Bear, which people whose opinions I respected were saying, this is the book. It's one of these books that I mentioned before with a prehistoric background. And it's a fun book. It's an interesting book. But people were touting, word of mouth got around that this was the most important book of this coming fall. And I kind of fell for it. And a lot of people were whispering about it. It was a great disappointment.
It's nevertheless on the bestseller list now.
Just beginning to, isn't it?
Yeah. But you never know with these things how much of it is publicity. But of course, as you say, books have a life of their own. There's also that also seemed like the kind of book where an agent or a publisher made a big statement about themselves by signing it and had a lot personally invested in it.
Yes, yeah.
And that happens every so often too, sure. I guess. So what can you get from the book conventions? It sounds like a carnival. What's useful about it?
Well, you do. I mean, basically, you go around and you talk to publicists. There, you learn after a year. I've learned the people who I can trust and who will really say who will not oversell a book to you, who will say this will be a good book and it's an interesting book. You should take a look at it and think about it yourself instead of the book. The people who come on and say this. I mean, there's one guy that writes me a little note with every book, and the notes run from, this will be a classic in its time, to a gem, you've never read anything like it, or this is, you know, this every book about an adolescent is the next Catcher in the Rye. You learn to just ignore these people.
We talked a little bit before about the trends you've seen in the past year. Do you have any glimpses to share with us about the year that's coming?
Well, I just hope that some of the major writers will be coming out. I know Philip Roth has got a new book. You don't find out too much about the subject matter or anything like that. To tell you the truth, the spring and what happens is you get the big push of Christmas season books now. Then publishers kind of are like bears. They hibernate for about 3 months in the winter, and then they'll come out with their really blockbusters in the spring. I haven't done my homework enough to know exactly what we're looking forward to next year. That I should know by January or February.
We'll be reading the book page to see what's new and what's out. Becky Sinkler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For coming to Fresh Air this afternoon. I've been speaking with Rebecca Sinkler, who's the book page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And again, in yesterday's paper, there's a list of the best books of 1980 and some comments by Becky about trends of this past year. It's 3:15, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be Ted Solotaroff, who is now a literary editor, and he's edited books by Tom Robbins, Norman Mailer, many other authors. And he's written extensively about literature for magazines like Commentary. So he'll be with us in just a few minutes on Fresh Air. This is Red Norville.